Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 698, Echoes of Dealey Plaza, subtitled Update on the Assassination of President Kennedy. We were talking at the end of Side 1 about how George Joannides had been the principal CIA liaison to many of the anti-Castro Cuban groups that were involved in the CIA's clandestine war against Castro, including and especially the DRE, to which Carlos Bringer belonged. That was one of the groups that was involved with tainting Oswald Red, and Carlos Bringer, a member of that group, was present in the WDSU interview. Bear in mind that the WDSU interview was broadcast all over the United States the evening of President Kennedy's assassination. It made it look like a communist had killed Kennedy. That, in turn, is, in the opinion of many researchers, kept a lot of liberals quiet. They were afraid that if the truth came out, it would have led to a Third World War. What is interesting is the extent to which that WDSU interview appears to have been set up by elements of the intelligence community. And we should also note that it was down in New Orleans that New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison conducted his investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy. And time permitting, we're going to talk a little bit about that at the end of this side. However, we're going to listen to an excerpt from The Guns of November, Part 1. This is featured in other programs. This is an excerpt that deals not only with the intelligence connections of the people who set up the interview with Lee Harvey Oswald at WDSU in New Orleans. Again, this from August of 1963. But you'll also get to hear Oswald himself representing his situation. And this, again, by way of understanding the forces that were tainting Oswald Red. And so this is from The Guns of November, Part 1, from November 1st of 1963.
Now, recall how when we dealt with the Francis Gary Powers book, Operation Overflight, Powers was the first of many to intimate that Lee Harvey Oswald was basically a Soviet sympathizer or agent who was responsible for downing the U-2 and consequently scotching the summit conference between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Now, Oswald did indeed defect, emigrate to the Soviet Union. While in the Soviet Union, he got a job at a radio factory, was interviewed by a number of people in the U.S. Embassy, all of whom later turned out to be CIA officials, or agents, I should say. And then, despite the fact that he had supposedly committed treason against the United States and espionage by revealing top-secret information on North American air defenses as well as the U-2's radar situation, that he then encountered remarkably little difficulty in getting back into the United States. He did this. The action of getting Oswald back into the U.S. was initiated through a letter to Texas Senator John Tower, who became chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And Oswald got back into the United States, was never indicted or prosecuted for his espionage, and was able to move about the United States rather freely. Now, one of the interesting things is that Lee Harvey Oswald began work on behalf of Fidel Castro, or at least allegedly so. He became not only the head of, but the sole member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, and as it turned out, he was the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, but he was not the only person who hung around their headquarters.
Let me stress also this point that Dave is making. Now, on one level, now remember out there, those of you who are not so familiar with some of the subject matter that we're talking about or with the dealings of intelligence, it is very important to remember that the key thing going on here is the difference between reality and appearance. And in this case, Lee Harvey Oswald, who defected to the Soviet Union claiming that he was going to give away all of America's top secret information on air defense and things of this nature, went to Russia, came back, and as a matter of fact, in the process of moving back, I believe he even received a $400 loan from somebody in the government through the State Department to enable him to finish up his affairs and to be able to get back to the United States. When he came into the country, he was never what's called a post-situational interview. He was never debriefed. Thank you very much. He was never debriefed. As a matter of fact, the only person out to meet this heinous defector who'd gone to the Soviet Union, our Cold War enemy, in pitched battle to give them all of our air secrets, the only man out to meet him was a gentleman by the name of Spaz T. Rakin, who was theoretically was a representative of Traveler's Aid, but was in fact a representative of several Eastern European violently, almost fanatically anti-communist groups who came out in a very friendly manner to meet this Soviet defector, this pro-Castro, pro-Russian defector, instead of any kind of government official who might want to know what Lee Harvey Oswald had talked to the Soviets about while he was in Russia.
It's interesting, too, that Oswald, the supposed leftist, associated with an enormous number of right-wing people. Now, something we're going to talk about next week and in weeks to come concerns the fact that the address for Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, recall he was its only member, opened on, it basically was in a building which had another entrance on a different street. One was 544 Camp Street and one was 541 Lafayette Place in New Orleans. I can never remember which was which. Which was the head of the, which was the headquarters of the so-called Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and which was an office of a former FBI agent and ultra-right winger named Guy Bannister.
544 Camp Street was the address on Oswald's literature. And again, we're talking about appearance versus reality. Lee Harvey Oswald has had a series of handbills printed up that said he, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, of which he was only the treasurer, supposedly, and it had an address of 544 Camp Street. In reality, he may have been the treasurer. He also would have had to have been the president, the vice president, all the members, because as Dave said, he was the only member. And 542 Lafayette Street was the address kitty-cornered. In other words, it was a building on a corner. One corner was 544 Camp Street. The door on the other corner was 542 Lafayette Street. They both led up to a first-floor landing, and the office space shared on that first-floor landing with Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee was the offices of a detective who was a former CIA,
FBI
agent who had many contacts with the anti-Castro Cuban crowd and the Bay of Pigs crowd by the name of Guy Bannister.
None of that, but Guy Bannister was affiliated with Division 5 of the FBI, which is the Internal Security Division. Now, Oswald got in a very highly publicized street altercation with a guy named Carlos Bringer, who is a Cuban exile affiliated with CIA, and this resulted eventually in an on-air interview between Oswald and a couple of individuals that Nip Tuck is going to tell you about. And this is interesting because this interview certainly laid the groundwork for representing Oswald as a communist sympathizer, if not indeed a Soviet agent, whereas the official version of the Warren Commission's thesis, the Warren Commission thesis was that Oswald was a lone nut. And when the facts of the situation are examined, Oswald's contacts appear to be overwhelmingly not only right, but far right. And it's worth noting here that there was a definite and apparently deliberate effort to represent Oswald as a leftist and to achieve a great deal of publicity with this effort.
Okay, I'm going to be reading from a book entitled Conspiracy. It's by Anthony Summers. It was published in 1980 by McGraw-Hill Books. As a matter of fact, got a lot of very good reviews when it came out. A very scholarly book on the subject of Lee Harvey Oswald and his intelligence contacts.
Summers is a BBC reporter who was commissioned by the BBC to undertake its investigation of the Kennedy assassination.
All right. Once again, reading from Conspiracy and talking first and foremost about a man named Carlos Bringer, with whom Lee Harvey Oswald had a very publicized shoving match, which enabled him to become known in media circles as a Marxist, because of course then he was dragged onto radio programs and interviewed by newspaper reporters, because somebody who was willing to go out in public and hand out handbills for Castro in those days was quite a bit more visible than they would be these days. So once again, that's the first person we're going to be talking about, is this anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Carlos Bringer. And I read from Summers' book as follows. Carlos Bringer, the exile in the New Orleans clash with Oswald, certainly had contact with the CIA. He was a New Orleans delegate of the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, the outgrowth of a militant Cuban student group. The group had naturally been deeply involved with the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion and continued to receive funds afterward. The Assassinations Committee found that Bringer had reported his contact with Oswald to his group's headquarters in Miami, and that the information had in turn been relayed to the CIA. A document obtained from the agency, that's from the CIA itself, reveals that the CIA had, quote, past contact with Carlos Bringer. Contact was limited to domestic service activities, unquote. As we noted in the case of George de Morenschild's CIA contacts, the Domestic Contacts Division is best known for its efforts to obtain information from travelers returning from communist countries. However, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title rather than, quote, Domestic Operations Division. The clandestine department, which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Let me go back and just restate that real quickly. The agency's own memos revealed that they had had past contacts with Carlos Bringier, which they claimed the contact was limited to domestic service activities. However, and I quote again from Summers, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title, namely Domestic Services, rather than Domestic Operations Division, the clandestine department which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Carlos Bringier, as New Orleans head of the DRE, also published a right-wing news sheet backed by the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee. The committee was funded by the CIA. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Very little about that, it seems, was spontaneous. First, Carlos Bringier called William Stuckey, a young reporter who had a weekly radio program on station WDSU. Stuckey went to see Oswald and found him a clean-cut, articulate figure, quite the opposite of the unkempt, wild-looking left-wing prototype he had anticipated. After recording and broadcasting the initial interview, one which he would later recall as oddly, quote, deliberate, Stuckey then began planning a follow-up debate program. What ensued was a classic case of media manipulation for political profit. Stuckey found himself positively showered with information guaranteed to smear Oswald. First, there was a telephone conversation with either the head or the deputy head of the local FBI office, who obligingly read out aloud large extracts from Oswald's file. Thus did Stuckey learn of Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union. Soon, the industrious Bringier popped up again, eager to impress similar information on the reporter. He said he had obtained it by sending an anti-Castro colleague to see Oswald, posing as a Castro sympathizer. Finally, the same day, Stuckey received a phone call from Edward Butler, director of a right-wing propaganda information called the Information Council of the Americas, or INCA, I-N-C-A. Butler confided that after telephone calls to Washington, he had confirmed Oswald's Soviet connections with, quote, someone at the House Un-American Activities Committee. The very title, Council of the Information Council of the Americas, speaks volumes for its origins and allegiances. At the time of the Oswald revelations, its manager was a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the anti-Castro government in exile created by the CIA.
Okay, now we're in just a second going to play you the interview, a tape of the interview that was conducted by Jim Stuckey, Ed Butler, and Carlos Bringier with Lee Harvey Oswald on WDSU. Now, before we get into the tape, two details that I'd like to call to your attention, two things to pay close attention to. First of all, in the very beginning of the interview, Lee Harvey Oswald was going to be asked a question about his status, about the status of his citizenship while in the Soviet Union, and his reply is very halting. He stutters, but he initially says that at all times while in the Soviet Union, he was under the protection of the United States government, and then he quickly he hems and haws and backtracks and negates that.
Now, again, just to clue you into this stuff, because it all goes by rather quickly, a very odd thing for somebody to say, or even to claim any kind of connection with the U.S. government, for somebody who is supposedly and purportedly defected to the Soviet Union because of his disgust with the United States and with the avowed purpose of giving away America's military secrets.
Also, take note of the fact that Carlos Bringier, right, the member of the DRE, the CIA-sponsored Cuban student group, that Carlos Bringier asks a very provocative question of Lee Harvey Oswald. He mentions that Castro characterized President Kennedy as a ruffian and a thief, then asks Lee Harvey Oswald whether he agrees with Castro's characterization of Kennedy. This is worth noting because the tape of this interview that we're going to play was broadcast all over the United States the evening of the assassination. So basically what you're about to hear was heard by all of America on the evening that JFK was assassinated.
All right. So once again, this is William Stuckey's radio interview, and the participants are the people that we have outlined. Carlos Bringier, a anti-Castro Cuban with CIA contacts. Ed Butler, a very prominent right-winger, later with contacts to the John Birch Society and other groups, also with CIA contacts. And Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of John F. Kennedy.
Stuckey and I are talking with three guests, Lee Harvey Oswald, who is local secretary of a group called Fair Play for Cuba, and with Ed Butler, the executive director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringer, a Cuban refugee and obviously anti-Castro. Mr. Oswald, as you might imagine, is on the hot seat tonight, and I believe, Bill Stuckey, you have a question for him.
Mr. Oswald, I believe you said in reply to a question from Mr. Butler that any questions about your background were extraneous to the discussion tonight. I disagree because of the fact that you refused to reveal any of the other members of your organization, so you are the face of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Therefore, anybody who might be interested in this organization ought to know more about you. For this reason, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long, drawn-out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. This requires a certain amount of technicalities, technical papers, and so forth. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship, and at no time was I out of contact or with the American embassy.
May I interrupt just one second? Either one of these two statements is wrong. The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine of 4936 Collingwood Street, Fort Worth, Texas, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date, and it said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, this seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I'm back in the United States. A person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
Right, and Soviet authorities, this is from the Washington Post and Times Herald of November 16, 1959, Soviet authorities had refused to grant it, although they had informed him that he could live in Russia as a resident alien. What did you do during the 2 weeks from October 31st to November 16, 1959?
As I have already stated, of course, this is a whole conversation, and we don't have too much time left, is getting away from the Cuban-American problem. However, I'm quite willing to discuss myself for the remainder of this program. As I have stated, it is very difficult for a resident, for a foreigner to get permission to reside in the Soviet Union. During those 2 weeks and during the date that you mentioned, I was, of course, with the knowledge of the American embassy, getting this permission.
Were you ever in a building at 11 Kuznetskaya Street in Moscow?
Kuznetskaya?
Mm-hmm.
Kuznetskaya is the, that would be probably the foreign ministry, I assume. No, I was never in that place, although I know Moscow, having lived there.
Let me interrupt, and I think Mr. Oswald is right to this extent. We should get around to the organization which he is the head of here in New Orleans, Fair Play for Cuba.
Committee.
As a practical matter, Mr. Oswald, knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the Fair Play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist members of rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government toward Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly toward the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist-controlled, regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia. regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when in his last speech of July 26 of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regard to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestra, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comment and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
You've never been to Cuba, of course, but why are the people in Cuba starving today?
Well, in any country emerging from a semi-colonial state and embarking upon reforms which require a diversification of agriculture, you're going to have shortages. After all, 80% of imports into the United States from Cuba were two products, tobacco and sugar. Nowadays, while Cuba is reducing its product as far as sugarcane goes, it is striving to grow unlimited and unheard of for Cuba quantities of certain vegetables, sweet potatoes, lima beans, cotton, and so forth, so that they can become agriculturally independent.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is almost up. We've had three guests tonight on Conversation Carte Blanche. Bill Stuckey and I have been talking with Lee Harvey Oswald, Secretary of the New Orleans Chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Ed Butler, Executive Director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Brignere, a Cuban refugee. Thank you very much, and good evening.
All right, and that was the voice of Lee Harvey Oswald, as well as the others introduced, and some rather interesting things that we pointed out before, which we hope you got a chance to catch, and some rather interesting things set up for all time. And one, again, cannot help but notice the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, a communist, supposed communist with no organization whatsoever, managed to make his Marxist sympathies and his relationship to the Castro regime and the Russian government awfully well known for a man with a committee of one.
Keep in mind that this interview was in August of 1963, about 3 months before Kennedy was killed, and it was aired, as we said, the evening of the assassination. Everybody heard what you just heard, and, well, what conclusions do you think they were supposed to draw?
That again from the Guns of November Part 1. That was recorded on November 1st of the year 1983. And that in turn is dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy. And you heard Lee Harvey Oswald from August of 1963. By the way, you also heard the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. And the entire Guns of November series, like everything else I've done, available for download for free at SpitfireList.com. So again, very interesting to contemplate that George Joannides was the CIA's liaison to many of the anti-Castro Cuban groups, including the DRE, and he also had served as the CIA's liaison to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. As badly compromised as the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation was, it ultimately wound up reinforcing the results of Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans. We're going to excerpt very briefly the book Let Justice Be Done by Bill Davey. And he talks about the conclusions of the assistant counsel for the House Select Committee who was involved with the new, oversaw the New Orleans aspects of the investigation. Quoting now from Let Justice Be Done, House Select Committee on Assassinations Chief Counsel G. Robert Blakey once referred to the committee's work as, quote, the last investigation, unquote. As such, it is only proper that the House Select Committee on Assassinations have the last word on Clay Shaw. Parenthetically, that was the first of the suspects he was the second of the suspects that Garrison was after. David Ferry died under strange circumstances. Continuing, on September 1st, 1977, staff counsel Jonathan Blackmer authored a 15-page memorandum addressed to G. Robert Blakey as well as other staff members, Gary Cornwell, Ken Kline, and Cliff Fenton. Blackmer was the lead counsel for Team 3, the HSCA team responsible for the New Orleans and Cuban angles of the investigation. After an investigative trip to New Orleans, Blackmer concluded in his memo, quote, "We have reason to believe Shaw was heavily involved in the anti-Castro efforts in New Orleans in the 1960s and was possibly one of the high-level planners or cutout," unquote, to the planners of the assassination itself. The first of Garrison's suspects was David Ferry. Ultimately, the House Select Committee on Assassinations wound up endorsing investigations of both Garrison suspects, both dead at this point. What is interesting is that there appears to have been an infiltrator in Garrison's investigation as well, who may very well have been involved with killing either David Ferry and or Eladio Del Valle, his CIA associate, his former CIA associate. On the day Ferry died, Del Valle was found brutally murdered. This, by the way, again, from Let Justice Be Done. On the day Ferry died, Del Valle was found brutally murdered in his car in the parking lot of a Miami shopping center. Prior to that, Garrison had been sent a part-time investigator named Bernardo de Torres to question Del Valle. De Torres was a military coordinator for Brigade 2506 as part of the Exile Landing Force during the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was captured by Castro's forces and detained until Christmas Eve of 1962. He eventually found his way to New Orleans, where, according to De Torres, he was approached by Sergeant Duffy of the New Orleans Police Department and asked to join Garrison's staff. First of all, it was De Torres who showed up in the DA's office in New Orleans very early in Garrison's investigation, claiming he had important information. He said he was a private detective who wanted to help and drop the name of Miami DA Richard Gerstein as an entree. Shortly after, De Torres was given the assignment to question Del Valle. Shortly after De Torres was given the assignment to question Del Valle, Del Valle's brutalized body was discovered in the vicinity of De Torres's Miami apartment. It was later determined that De Torres was filing reports on Garrison to the Miami CIA station JM Wave. Not long after he left Garrison's staff, De Torres went to work for Mitch Werbel's Military Armaments Corporation, a large supplier of weaponry to the CIA. The HSCA developed evidence that De Torres was actually a CIA officer with links to military intelligence. A well-connected anti-Castro Cuban, Arturo Cobos, told the FBI that De Torres was, quote, "the man to call with contacts on a high level with the CIA in Washington, D.C., unquote. The HSCA also came into possession of investigative information which indicated that De Torres may have been in Dealey Plaza at the time of the assassination, and further, that he may have been involved in an assassination conspiracy, charges which De Torres denies. As for Garrison, he later came to believe that De Torres was one of his earliest sources of misinformation and recalled that whatever information De Torres provided never went anywhere. In the late 1970s, De Torres would be linked to the bombing assassination of Chilean leader Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. So again, the echoes of Dealey Plaza resound very, very profoundly throughout subsequent American history. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 698, Echoes of Dealey Plaza, subtitled Update on the Assassination of President Kennedy. This program is being recorded on December 24th of 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.